Welcome to The Journey, a chronological study which goes through scripture from Genesis to Revelation in chronological order.
So it says, very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin made their plans. So they bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. We're going to talk about Pilate here in a second. His motivations are not actually too difficult to sort of understand. And the scripture actually tells us, it gives us enough clues, I think, that to kind of fill in the gaps of why Pilate does what he does. Matthew 27 says, early in the morning, all the chief priests and the elders of the people made their plans how to have Jesus executed. So I think Matthew says this really directly. They're not looking at finding out whether Jesus is guilty. Obviously, this has never been about that, right? We saw, as Meredith pointed out, the trial's been a sham from the beginning. They're not interested in actually determining if Jesus has done anything wrong. They just want to kill him, and they want some legitimacy to being able to kill him. And the only reason they're probably worried about legitimacy is because they don't want a revolt. They don't want the crowds who do love Jesus, some of them still do, to turn on them. And so they're looking for a way to make it seem, they're just looking for justification. So when it says, you know, they made their plans how to have Jesus executed, that's what it says. Their conclusion in the trial was that Jesus was guilty of blasphemy. They tried all sorts of other charges and nothing else would stick because the witnesses couldn't, even witnesses who were making up stories couldn't agree. And so then Jesus finally lays it out there for them and says that he will be on the clouds, that he is the Son of Man, that he is the Messiah, basically, you know, that he is God, gives them as much as they want. So the charge is blasphemy. The reality is, and again, I have heard and shared differently, that they could execute, they did have rights, apparently, under the Roman rule and under Jewish law. They had the rights to go ahead and perform capital punishment when it came to blasphemy. That was considered a religious issue that the Romans didn't want to deal with. The Romans wouldn't execute someone for blasphemy because they didn't care, at least not Jewish blasphemy. They might for their own, I suppose. So they were fine with the Jews doing that. But in this case, I think what we see is that, again, it's a step a little bit too far. For the trial's not been great. It's been a sham. For them to go the extra mile and actually execute Jesus themselves, you know, to take him out and stone him as they do with Stephen and others later, to take him out and stone him, again, it just runs the risk of the crowd getting too riled up. And so I think they want to actually let somebody else do it for them. So as they're making their plans, what they decide in their plans is that they're going to take him to Pilate. Pilate is the governor of Judea. He's in charge of this area. And so he's in charge of things like justice and capital punishment for political crimes, which they haven't charged Jesus with, but they're going to figure out somehow how to make it stick with Pilate. One of the things that's interesting, and we've mentioned how bad the trial was, and we'll continue to talk about that because it keeps coming up. One of the things that we also know, so it says, no court of justice in Israel was permitted to hold sessions on Sabbath or any of the seven biblical holidays. That's fine. Again, according to John, they're doing this the day before the biblical holiday starts and the day before Sabbath. But it says this too, in cases of capital crime, this comes, by the way, if you care, from Isaac Weiss's book called The Martyrdom of Jesus, in which he has looked into the laws as they existed at the time. It says, in case of capital crime, no trial could be commenced on Friday or the day previous to any holiday, because it was not lawful either to adjourn such cases longer than overnight or to continue them on the Sabbath or the holiday. In other words, in a capital case, the goal is to have enough time for the defendant to really defend himself and for there to be enough consideration, but also to have it happen quickly enough that it isn't drug out forever. And so towards that end, because you're not allowed to have sessions on a Sabbath, you aren't allowed to start a capital crime on the day before a Sabbath because you can't adjourn it that same day. You're not allowed to do that unless it's an acquittal, and you can't carry it overnight because it's Sabbath and you have to leave on the Sabbath. So it's illegal for them. Actually, it's just another reason it's illegal for them to even be having a capital case on the day before the Sabbath. They were in a hurry to get it done before the Passover because they feared that the riots would get worse if they did things like on the Passover, or that Jesus would get too much popularity if they didn't do it before the Passover. So that's just another example where they were willing to lay aside their law just to try to get Jesus executed. So arresting him on the day before Sabbath, the first day of unleavened bread, was a problem. Anyway, they make their plans. They're trying to figure out how to get him executed. They decided that it's not safe enough for them to do it, even though with the charge of blasphemy, legally they could, if any of this were legal. But they decide to have Pilate do it, or see if they can get Pilate to do it, so they can have some, they can have the best of both worlds. They can claim that they charged him and it was done legally, but they themselves weren't the ones who killed Jesus. And all the way through, you're going to see people kind of trying to pass the buck on executing Jesus. No one quite wants to do it, but everybody's afraid to not do it. And we'll see that with both Pilate and Herod in a second. So it says they bound him, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate, the governor. Luke says it this way in chapter 22. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. If you are the Messiah, they said, tell us. And Jesus answered, if I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I ask you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. They all asked, are you then the Son of God? He replied, you say that I am. Then they said, why do we need any more testimony? We have heard it from his own lips. We actually already saw this in the previous Gospels, but it's shifted a little bit here. As I pointed out last week, I happen to have a note, so I'll just point it out again. Jewish law states this: a criminal case resulting in the acquittal of the accused may terminate the same day on which the trial begins. But if a sentence of death is to be pronounced, it cannot be concluded before the following day. So according to the Mishnah, which is sort of commentaries on scripture that go back thousands and thousands of years, according to Mishnah on the Sanhedrin, the point is this: that if you're charging somebody with a crime which is going to result in their death, they cannot be found guilty quickly. If they are acquitted in one day, that's great; they're free, they can go. If they're found guilty, they have to wait another day and continue to have deliberations. And again, the idea is to give the defendant a chance to defend himself. So again, the fact they're doing this all so quickly for a capital case is a problem. They didn't give Jesus a chance to find witnesses in support of himself. In fact, you know, all his witnesses have fled or are hiding outside. I also pointed out last week that even a unanimous verdict on a capital case, the law has this weird quirk in the Jewish world that says if it's unanimous and quick, then it actually means acquittal. You don't even get to keep deliberating. And the reason for that, again, is there's an assumption that if it's unanimous and quick, it's railroading somebody. It's a setup. It's a conspiracy, which in this case, it absolutely is. And so there has to be a defense. There has to be someone in the Sanhedrin who acts like a defense attorney and says no in order for a capital case even to be considered legal. And there's nobody here who's doing that because the people who would have said no aren't here. And we know that for sure because Joseph of Arimathea, we're told later, did not agree with the decision being made here. And he's in the Sanhedrin, so apparently he just wasn't here. I think probably the same is true of Nicodemus, but it doesn't say that for sure. All right. The other thing is that it specifically states in the law that a sentence of death can only be pronounced from the appointed courts. They did not take Jesus to the appointed courts. They're doing this in Caiaphas's house. So once again, all these safeguards that are in the Jewish law to prevent someone from being railroaded into death is exactly what's being ignored. And exactly what's happening is he's being railroaded to death. So you see, the reason for all these laws was to prevent this. So they ignore them all so they can do it. All right. Matthew 27, verse 3. When Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. I have sinned, he said, for I have betrayed innocent blood. So whatever Judas's motivations are mysterious. They're not given to us. We don't know what is going through his head. But apparently he does believe now, and maybe always did, that Jesus was innocent. Perhaps part of his remorse and shock is that this happened so fast, right? He knew in capital cases what the laws should be. He knew that Jesus should have a chance to defend himself. He knew that witnesses should be called on Jesus's behalf. Maybe that was what he was counting on. Maybe he expected all that to happen and Jesus would kind of rise up out of this an even stronger person than he had been. I don't know. We don't know what the motivation is. Maybe Judas was jealous. Maybe he hated Jesus for other reasons. But even though he hated Jesus, he still feels remorseful that it's come to this. It just doesn't tell us. But it does tell us that these are his words. I have sinned, for I have betrayed innocent blood. He goes back to the chief priests. He says, he tries to return the money. He says, this was a mistake. Take it back. And their answer is extraordinarily callous for everybody, for Jesus, for Judas, for everybody. They say, what is that to us? They replied, that's your responsibility. So again, all the way along through this, people are passing the buck. Judas, ironically, is one of the few who actually accepts his role in this. And they say, yeah, it's your fault. We don't care. We don't want your money. So Judas threw the money into the temple and left. Then he went away and hanged himself. Tragic. Money he just throws into the temple, he doesn't want it. I think that the idea that he threw it is they don't want it. Because again, it's bad money. It's illegal. It's obviously immoral. It's unethical. There's all sorts of problems with it. Nobody wants to touch it now, and Judas doesn't want it. Then it says the chief priest picked up the coins and said, it's against the law to put this in the treasury since it is blood money. It's fascinating. They're suddenly worried about the law. They haven't been all along. And I think what it shows is they're not worried about the law. They're worried about how it looks. They're worried about, you know, if anybody finds out, you know, here's this money we paid, we shouldn't have paid. It's against the law to pay a witness to testify against somebody. We shouldn't have done this. He threw it back in here. We just need to get rid of this money. We don't want it. It's bad money. So they decided to use the money to buy the Potter's Field as a burial place for foreigners. I imagine this was like a PR move, right? You know, look how compassionate we are. We're going to buy a burial place for people who aren't even part of us, so they have a place to bury their dead. That is why it has been called the Field of Blood to this day. Then what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. They took the 30 pieces of silver, the price set on him by the people of Israel, and they used them to buy the Potter's Field as the Lord commanded me. There is another passage we'll come to later, which says that Judas died a different way. There is a way to reconcile those two. We'll talk about it when we get to that other one, but just in case that's in your head, it is. But we'll talk about that when we get there. Okay, Mark 15. They've taken over to Pilate. How can we kill him? Well, let's get Pilate to do our dirty work for us. Let's get the governor to do it. Again, the governor will not execute Jesus for blasphemy, so they have to figure out how they're going to get Pilate to do what they want. So here we go. Mark 15, 2-5. Are you king of the Jews? Asked Pilate. So this is an interesting question. So this kind of jumps into the middle. One of the other gospels is going to give us a little more detail here. Mark, being Mark, likes to keep things succinct. So he kind of jumps into the middle, but you can tell from Pilate's question, it's not about blasphemy, is it? He's not asking Jesus if Jesus is God or the Messiah or any of the things that he's been charged with. He's asking him if he's king. And that gives us a hint as to what Pilate thinks the charge is. And he doesn't think it's blasphemy. He wouldn't be talking to Jesus if that was it. He would have simply sent him back to them. We'll see as we go forward. The other Gospels will make it more clear what Pilate thinks the charge is. But you might be able to figure it out too, just from the questions he asks. Are you king of the Jews? Asked Pilate. You have said so, Jesus replied. The chief priests accused him of many things. So again, Pilate asked him. I like this too. It's kind of like the chief priest said to Jesus did a lot of stuff in trying to get Pilate to take the case. So Pilate is trying to ask the one question that gives him any legal room to maneuver at all. So he asks again, aren't you going to answer? See how many things they are accusing you of. They tell you all these things. Just tell me, are you king of the Jews? But Jesus still made no reply. And Pilate was amazed. So here again, Jesus has a chance to speak up. We'll see later. Pilate has every reason, political self-interest reason, not to execute Jesus. Jesus probably could have gotten out of this again if he spoke up, if he wanted to. There's actually a very simple thing he could have said, and I'll show you that later, that he refuses to say, even though it would have been true, because it would have gotten him out of trouble, and that's not his plan right now. Okay, Matthew 27 says it this way. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, are you the king of the Jews? You have said so, Jesus replied. When he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate asked him, don't you hear the testimony they are bringing against you? But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. Luke 23. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, we have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Messiah, a king. Now we see what the charges are. Blasphemy won't get him anywhere with Pilate, but what will get him somewhere with Pilate is the idea of treason. If Jesus is in fact claiming to be king of the Jews in a way that threatens Rome's right to be king, Rome's right to be the leader, then that's treason. To claim to be a rival of Caesar's is treason. So that's why they're saying things like, well, he's subverting our nation and he opposes payment of taxes to Caesar. And he claims to be Messiah, which means nothing to you, but let us tell you, Pilate, that means king. This is the charge. So they found him guilty of blasphemy, but when they come to Pilate, they completely change the whole plea. They're like, yeah, we didn't mean blasphemy. We meant treason, because you can execute him for treason. So trust us, we found him guilty of treason. To which Pilate says, is this true? And Jesus could very honestly have said no. He could have completely said, no, I'm not trying to subvert the nation. I'm not refusing to pay taxes. I'm not trying to be king in the sense that you're worried about of this world. He could have said any of those things. And Pilate would have probably said, you know what? This is your deal. You guys deal with him. I have nothing to do with this. But because Jesus, again, keeps quiet, these accusations stick. They aren't kind of gone against. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, we have found the man subverting our nation. He opposes payments of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Messiah, a king. So Pilate asked Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? So this is where Mark jumped in, right? So Matthew's giving us more information of what led to this question. And what led to this question was the Sanhedrin saying, yeah, he's a traitor. He's a treason, and he's a threat to the Roman government. And that is absolutely in Pilate's wheelhouse. Are you king of the Jews? You have said so, Jesus replied. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests in the crowd, I find no basis for a charge against this man. He's like, you keep saying he's committed treason. I just don't see it, because he hasn't, right? He's like, I don't see it. There's no charge here. And part of the problem is they're trying to, this is what happens when you're deceitful and duplicitous. What they want to say is he's guilty of blasphemy, which, by the way, he is, if he's not actually God. But they can't say that because Pilate doesn't care about that. So they made up this other charge, which they haven't even found him guilty of. And now they're stuck because Pilate's like, I don't even see that. So how do you prove something that you weren't even trying to prove 5 minutes ago? But they insisted. He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here. Now, that isn't actually, again, an indictable offense either. He's stirring people up. They're implying he's starting revolts. They're implying he's trying to overturn the Roman government. We know, we've been through the Gospels, that's not what Jesus has been doing. But that's what the implication is, and that's what they're trying to make stick. On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at the time. So Herod is sort of the king of Galilee, or the, I don't remember what the exact word is now, but the leader of Galilee. Remember, it's kind of split into quarters, and he is one of those leaders, and he's the leader of Galilee. And so Pilate, what he's really doing here is he sees an out. So let's talk about Pilate a little bit so we understand kind of what he's wrestling with. Now, some of the things I'm going to share with you, I mentioned a book last week called The Day Christ Died, written by a guy named Jim Bishop. And if you want to kind of look into this more, you can read his book. It's a little bit older, but from the newer research that I've done, it appears that his work still stands pretty well. But also the things he says are borne out by the things we see Pilate do. And one really kind of small sentence that's going to come up later makes the most sense if we understand it the way Jim Bishop does. And so that's what we're going to talk about just a little bit. So Pilate is a governor of Judea. We know historically that Pilate is on probation. What that means is that Herod, who is over he's higher ranking than Pilate, and the emperor, obviously, who's a higher ranker than both of them, are unhappy with Pilate. And the reason they're unhappy with Pilate is because he's had two revolts in Judea, in his area, like since his reign, which maybe the last 30, 40 years. And so, and again, we know historically there's some, Josephus and others talk about this. So he's had these revolts specifically from Jews, probably because of other false messiahs. And so in these revolts, Pilate's had to put them down, but it's caused more unrest, it's caused more problems, and he's been blamed for them by his superiors. They think that Pilate's a bad governor. Might be, in fact. There's nothing we see in all this that doesn't say he isn't. They think he's a bad governor. They think he can't keep the peace. Pax Romana is very important. Keeping peace is what Rome does. That's their justification for their authority, for their oppression, for everything, is that, look, we make everybody happy. We keep the peace work together, working really well. So he hasn't done that. He's had two revolts, and he's essentially been told, if you have a third revolt, you're out. And the problem with being out as governor of Judea is usually that doesn't just mean career suicide, although it might mean that. That's the best case scenario. It also very possibly means death for Pilate. So it's a big deal. He can't afford another revolt. So everything he does in his interaction with Jesus and the high priest and Herod, it's all political. It's all an attempt to not, it's all an attempt to keep peace. It's all an attempt to prevent another revolt. He doesn't care if Jesus is guilty or not guilty, or if the chief priests are right or wrong. All he cares about is, how can he get through this unscathed? He has to get through this without another black mark. So his thinking is, here's this guy that they're saying is stirring people up. They're saying he's claiming to be king. Well, that means this guy has a following. Jesus has a following. So Pilate's stuck between a rock and a hard place, because he says to himself, if I execute Jesus, which is what the chief priests want me to do, and they're powerful in their own way, but if I do what they want, will not the people revolt? Will I not experience the same kind of revolts I've experienced before? And then I'm in big trouble. So the first thing he wants to do is simply say, what are you even talking about? I don't see any charges. I don't see what you're saying. Just you take them, you deal with them. But they keep insisting and they keep pushing him back. And now Pilate's like, so if I don't do what they want me to do, and I refuse to execute Jesus, I might also cause a revolt, because these guys seem really determined to execute Jesus. And I don't want to burn my bridges with them either. They're the power structure of the Jews who I'm trying to keep peace with. So what do I do? And then they mention in this, in an aside, without meaning to, they give him an escape hatch. They say to Pilate, he's a Galilean. And as soon as he says he's a Galilean, Pilate says, oh, out of my jurisdiction. I don't have to deal with this anymore. Let Herod deal with it. But this is even better for Pilate, because it turns out, and again, we find this out in the scriptures here in just a little bit, turns out that Herod has been watching Jesus from afar. And Herod, as a self-proclaimed Jew and nominally one, is interested in this man, Jesus. And most of all, he's intrigued by the things he's heard about the signs that Jesus can do. So he kind of has always wanted, he has this curiosity about Jesus. So Pilate is about to kill two birds with one stone. And it feels to him, I'm sure, like the perfect solution. Number one, if he sends Jesus to Herod, he's no longer responsible. He avoids the dangers of a riot. He avoids the protests. He can pass the buck. He can say, it's out of my jurisdiction. But on top of that, he also can present this as a gift and a favor to Herod. He can say, hey, I'm sending you Jesus because I know you really wanted to meet him. And sure, I could have taken this and done what needed to be done, but I know how much you really wanted to know Jesus. So I'm sending him to you for you to deal with. So this is why Pilate sends Jesus to Herod. There's no real reason for him to do so, except it's convenient for him to pass the buck. And it's a favor to Herod. And we're going to see that it actually is, in fact, going to improve Herod and Pilate's relationship, which is what Pilate wanted. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, right? Because for a long time, he'd been wanting to see him. So there it is. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform a sign of some sort. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. So again, does Herod care if Jesus is guilty or not? No, he wants Jesus to do like a miracle for him. I don't know if any of you have seen Jesus Christ Superstar, but there is that song that Herod sings where he's like, you know, walk across my swimming pool. And he's trying to get him to do a sign. And that's kind of what's happening here, that Herod is just like, do something cool. Show me something cool. So he's asking him all these questions just to try to get to know him and get him to do a miracle and kind of see what he can do. It's very unsatisfying for Herod, because Jesus doesn't, you know, he's not going to play the drums. He's not going to do what Herod wants. He says he plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there vehemently accusing him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. So Herod's like, well, this is dumb. There's no charges here to be made. Jesus is just an idiot. He won't answer my questions. He's such a disappointment. He won't do the things I asked him to do. Apparently, according to the priest, he thinks he's king. So we'll dress him in a robe and we'll mock him and ridicule him. And then, though, he just sends it back to Pilate, which is unfortunate for Pilate on one hand, because he was really trying to get out of this decision. But on the other hand, it does say that day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. So you can see, again, this is a political maneuvering by Pilate. He's like, I'm going to send Herod this man, and then it'll ease our relationships. Then Herod will stop telling on me to the emperor and getting me in trouble. Maybe that's what had been happening. Whatever it is, Herod did appreciate the gesture, even though Jesus turned out to be just a huge disappointment as far as he's concerned. So that's the interaction. That's why he ends up with Pilate, because the Sanhedrin is just looking for a way to execute Jesus. Pilate doesn't want to do it. Finds a loophole, sends him to Herod for political reasons. Herod finds him completely unsatisfying, but doesn't have any interest in executing him, again, for no reason. Doesn't himself want to be responsible, so he sends it back to Pilate for Pilate to deal with, because they may be friends now, but I'm sure he doesn't care that much if Pilate gets in trouble. And then Pilate has received Jesus back. So now we're going to go to John 18. It steps back a little bit. I mean, it's going to quickly catch up to where we are, but just so you're not confused, this is going back to when the leaders bring him to Pilate. So let's start there. Then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So this is where John makes it very clear that the Passover was not the Last Supper, because these chief priests are avoiding going into the palace because it's a Gentile's place, and they don't want to be unclean for the Passover. Again, the two possibilities are that there's a Roman dated Passover and a Jewish dated Passover, and John and the chief priests are using one, and Jesus and the apostles were using another. That's a possibility. The other is that it wasn't Passover. It was just a supper that they were treating a little bit like Passover because Jesus knew he wouldn't be around for the actual one. Those are all things we talked about earlier. So Pilate came out to them and asked, what charges are you bringing against this man? If he were not a criminal, they replied, we would not have handed them over to you. This is the most Weasley answer, right? I mean, can you actually imagining this working in a court of law? Like the judge is like, so what are the charges you're bringing against this man, Mr. Prosecutor? And the prosecutor's like, well, obviously he's a criminal or we wouldn't have brought him. That doesn't work. But they don't want to tell him what the charges are because, again, the charges are blasphemy, which means nothing to Pilate. So they're just like, well, obviously he's a criminal or we wouldn't have brought him to you. That's great. Pilate said, take him yourselves and judge him by your own law. Pilate's like, okay, you're not going to tell me. You judge him. You have some authority. You have the right to do this. You judge him. What are you bringing him to me at all? But we have no right to execute anyone, they objected. Now, this is where for many years that we've understood that they couldn't execute people under Roman law. We know under Jewish law, they've always been allowed to. So the assumption was that this statement was made because they weren't allowed to under Roman law. But later research has shown us, in fact, the Jews did. And even the book of Acts tells us this. They executed Stephen while they were still under Roman law. So it doesn't seem that that's ever been the case. So again, I think the way to read this is that what they're going to claim to Pilate is that the charge is treason. And therefore, because it's treason, they don't have a right to execute him. They can only execute him for other things. They could execute him for blasphemy. They don't want to because they don't want to be responsible. So that's, again, that's the sort of tortured reasoning they're having to go through at this point. But we have no right to execute anyone, they objected. This took place to fulfill what Jesus said about the kind of death he was going to die. But John tells us that it's not even their machinations. It's because God decreed it this way, that it wasn't just going to be a stoning. If the Jews had executed him, it would have been a stoning. For him to be crucified on a cross, it has to be a Roman execution. The prophecies say that Jesus will die on a tree, that he will die in a cursed way. This matches the idea of crucifixion much better. And even the descriptions of being pierced for our transgressions and all those things and stripes, all these things fit much better the way he does die than it would have if he had simply been stoned by the Jews. So I think John's point is, yeah, the Jews think they're, you know, everybody thinks they're doing things, but we understand it's God who's doing things. And one of the things he's doing is getting Jesus away from the Jews and under the authority of the Romans, even though to do it, the Jews have to do these crazy machinations. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, Are you king of the Jews? Okay. Again, this is where Mark jumped in. And again, it shows us that Pilate doesn't understand the charge to be blasphemy. No one has suggested the charge is blasphemy. Or if they did, that's when he said, you go judge him under your own laws. And then they changed it to say, as Matthew pointed out, well, he's stirring up the people. He won't pay taxes and he wants to be king. So that's when he asked him, are you king of the Jews? Is that your own idea, Jesus asked, or did others talk to you about me? Jesus is like, wonder where you got that idea from, right? Am I a Jew? Jesus replied. And what Pilate means by that is, what do I care? What do I care if you're king of the Jews? As long as you're not trying to be king of the Romans, as long as you're not trying to usurp my authority or Herod's authority or the emperor's authority, what do I care? It's not my idea. Why would I be worried about this? He says, am I a Jew? Pilate replied, your own people and chief priests handed you over to me. Yeah, of course they're the ones who told me about it. I don't care. What is it you have done? I think Pilate's trying to get to it. What's really going on? Because I'm not getting the whole story. What is happening here? Just tell me. And Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is from another place. So Jesus gives a little bit of a hazy answer, but again, it's pretty clearly not a treasonous answer. He says, yeah, I'm not a king of your kingdom. I'm not trying to be. But he does make this interesting point. He says, if I was king of the Jews, as you mean, then I wouldn't be here because all those Jews would have fought on my behalf. They would have protected me and I would have let them. But this isn't my kingdom, so I'm not fighting for it. I'm willing to leave this kingdom because it's not mine. It can be, you can have it, in a sense, is what he's saying. Pilate says, you are a king then. Again, Pilate's just trying to figure out what to do with him. So he's trying to get something solid. You are a king then, said Pilate. Jesus answered, you say that I am king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. What is truth? Retorted Pilate. Now Pilate's starting to sound a little bit like the Greeks that have influenced Rome. He wants to get kind of philosophical here. And it makes sense because Jesus is beginning to talk sort of philosophically, right? First, he's talking about specifics of being a king. Then he's like, well, in your truth, I'm a king. You say I'm a king. But really, I'm here to testify to what is truth, to the truth. And Pilate's like, well, what is truth? What do you... Both ways this can be read. Number one is, what are you talking about when you say that you're testifying the truth? What do you mean? And the other is, yeah, the chief priests have their truth. I have my truth. You have your truth. What is truth? With this, he went out again to the Jews gathered there and said, look, all I know is this. I find no basis for a charge against him. So he's like, guys, I can't do this. Now, John skips the whole sending him to Herod thing. So this is after he's come back from Herod. Okay. So John just doesn't talk about the Herod thing. So he's been to Pilate. Are you king of the Jews? You say that I am. Sends him off to Herod, comes back. They have this argument. They continue to have some arguments about truth. Pilate has to make a decision because Herod's not taking care of it for him. He goes back out to the chief priest. He says, look, and now it says to the Jews gathered there. I think it still mostly means the chief priest, the Sanhedrin, the elders. Those are really the ones here at the palace. Perhaps there's a little bit of a crowd that's picked up, but I think mostly when it says the Jews in this context, it means those leaders. Says he goes out there and he says, look, I find no basis for a charge against him. There's just nothing here. This guy talks about being a kingdom of a world that's not our world. Look, that sounds crazy to me, but it doesn't sound treasonous. It doesn't sound like a problem. I find no basis for a charge against him. But I'll tell you what, he says. It is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. So apparently, and this was probably one of the peacemaking efforts that Pilate had made, I'm guessing, that somewhere in one of those revolts, one of the things that quieted people down was Pilate said, look, I will honor your Passover and I will release a prisoner that belongs to you every Passover. And what Pilate's trying to do is give them a way to save face. I think he thinks they're stuck like he is. He doesn't want to execute Jesus. He doesn't understand why they do. So I think he's trying to give them a way to save face. I think he's like, look, this isn't going to work. There's no charges against him. Herod found no charges. I found no charges. We need to let him go. But I understand you need a way to save face because you've invested a lot in this. So I'm going to give you an out. I'm going to give you a way to take it all back. You can just go back and pretend none of this happened. And that's when he says, it is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews? And they shouted back, no, not him. Give us Barabbas. Now, Barabbas had taken part in an uprising. Let's read the next one in Mark, which also talks about the same thing. And then we'll talk a little bit about Barabbas and where Barabbas comes in here, because he comes out of nowhere. But the point is, he's trying to give them an out, and the chief priests don't take it. They're not like, yes, great, you're right. This was all a mistake. Give us Jesus back. We'll say that we charged him. We'll say that we were right to do so, but we'll say that you showed compassion because it's Passover, and we showed compassion, and everybody wins. Jesus lives. We get out of this hole we built for dug for ourselves. You get out of the hole that we put you in. But they don't. They don't want him back. They want him executed. Okay, but let's read Mark 15 and see what else we see. Now, it was the custom at the festival to release a prisoner whom the people requested. A man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the uprising. This is fascinating. This is written as if we all know what it's talking about. And I think that means that whatever it's talking about is significant enough and recent enough that everybody does know it. That if you're reading this at the time that Mark is writing this, you know exactly what insurrection he's talking about. Likely, this is exactly one of the insurrections that Pilate was in trouble for. This is probably exactly one of the things that Pilate was on probation for, was this one of these insurrections, one of these revolts. And Barabbas was one of those insurrectionists who had killed people. It doesn't say how many or what, but he killed at least one person and committed murder in the uprising. So here's this guy named Barabbas. He's probably been in prison for a while. He's there for this insurrection. And that Mark is just giving us this background as we move forward. He says, the crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did. Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews? Asked Pilate, knowing that it was out of self-interest that the chief priests had handed Jesus over to him. But the chief priest stirred up the crowd to have Pilate release Barabbas instead. So it sounds like here in Mark, there is a crowd forming of, there's just other people there, probably for this custom that happens anyway. Pilate thinks if the chief priests aren't going to listen to him, he can do an end run around the chief priests, and maybe the crowd will call for Jesus to be released, and then they're all again out of this fix. The chief priests can say they tried their best, Pilate can say he tried his best, and Jesus can be free. And if it weren't for two things, and Jim Bishop speculates on one of these, the other one is right here in scripture. If it weren't for two things, it probably would have worked. There probably would have been people there who would have said, release Jesus. We want Jesus. Yeah, set him free, right? There's got to be a few disciples hanging out who would have said that. But two things happen. One is the chief priests actively take a role in stirring up the crowd to call for Barabbas, to call for a murderer, to call for a criminal to be released instead of Jesus. The other thing, and Jim Bishop speculates a little bit about this, but he says, notice that it says here at the beginning that the people came to Pilate asking him to do this. The people who were asking him to do this were probably people who were part of the insurrection, but were not in prison. They're probably people who were friends of Barabbas who went specifically to ask Pilate to release Barabbas. So they're a small but vocal minority that kind of start the cheering, the calls for Barabbas. The chief priests hear that, and then they circulate among the crowd and get everyone else to call for Barabbas. That's how Jim Bishop reads it. We don't know if that's how it happens, but the bottom line is that what happens here is they choose Barabbas instead of Jesus. Now, there's all sorts of interesting types here. And I see that Meredith has a thought, and I'll get to that in just a second. One thing I will point out, though, that's interesting is that we have one of many examples in this whole story where Jesus takes the place of a sinner. So here it's a very specific example of that. Instead of releasing the innocent man who deserves to go free, they release the sinner, the murderer, and Jesus takes his place. And that is such a good type of what the gospel is all about, that even that feels like, you know, look, God is pointing to it and saying, look, this is what Jesus does. He takes the place of the sinner and sets them free. So even though this is unfair and unjust and shouldn't have been done this way, again, this is a picture that God is giving us of the gospel. Okay, Meredith, yes, you had a thought or a question?
Oh, not really. I was just going to say that this one looks like the people were asking for it instead of Pilate trying to use it.
Yeah. So I think both are true. I think they're asking for it because it is what happens. Pilate sees it as a way to give Jesus and the chief priests an out, and the people who are asking for it, though, are wanting it for Barabbas. So I think they both dovetail. Yeah. So they call for Barabbas. Pilate's like, you guys are crazy. This is nuts. why are you asking for Barabbas? But he's like, well, that's fine. That's, I said I would give them, I got to do what they're asking. Again, I don't want to revolt from these guys either, these pro-Barabbas people. I don't want to revolt from them. But then he's still stuck with this problem. And so that's what he says. What shall I do then with the one you call the king of the Jews? Pilate asked them. And this is where you have to see the chief priest's involvement. Because if it's just pro-Barabbas people, they don't care about Jesus. I don't think they hate Jesus. I don't think they want Jesus to be crucified. But Pilate, I mean, but the chief priests are circulating among the crowd and they're stirring them up. It's like the mob mentality is really taking place here. And so when that question comes up, then suddenly the people are yelling, crucify him. I'm guessing half the crowd, and we've seen this happen in our own days, in our own recent history. We've seen in very lots of different examples. We've seen examples where mobs just do stuff and say stuff. And once they get going, half the people don't even have to know why they're doing it. You know, anytime there's a riot that starts, you know, there's a percentage of them that are just there for the riot. They don't even know what the protest was. They don't know what the injustice was. They're just there. And I think that's what's happening here, is the chief priests start circulating, and then you just got a bunch of people caught up in the whole craziness of a mob saying, kill him, crucify him, do it. And so the chief priests are really working the crowd, so to speak. Pilate was hoping they'd say, let him go. And Pilate would be like, yeah, let him go too, or throw him in prison, or anything short of crucifixion. But they don't. What shall I do then with the one you call king of the Jews? Pilate asked them. Crucify him, they shouted. Why? Pilate is just so, he's like perplexed. He's like, I don't understand what's happening here. He says, why? What crime has he committed? He's like, I don't even know what the charges are. I can't even get a clear answer on that. Why do you guys want him killed? But they shouted all the louder, crucify him. So again, just a mob. Not reasoning, not reasonable. They don't really care. Again, I suspect a lot of them don't even know what's going on or who Jesus is, but whatever is happening, they're all in now. And Pilate, it says exactly why he makes the decision he does. He says, wanting to satisfy the crowd. He cannot afford a riot. He cannot afford another insurrection. He's just trying to keep peace. So it says, wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. He's like, I give up. I don't understand what the charges are. I don't know what he's guilty of, but I can't afford to let you guys go off on me. And you guys seem to care. So without any charges, this is how we know Pilate isn't concerned about justice or care about Jesus. He's just trying to make peace without any charges. I'm going to flog him and hand him over to be crucified because it's what the mob wants. And so that's what he does. Matthew 27 tells the story this way. Now it was the governor's custom at the festival to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At the time, they had a well-known prisoner whose name was Jesus Barabbas. Just a coincidence. It's a common name, Jewish name, Joshua. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, which one do you want me to release to you? Jesus Barabbas or Jesus who is called the Messiah? Again, Jim Bishop points out that probably Pilate picked the most reprehensible person he could to contrast with Jesus. That if the way Matthew tells it, he gives them a binary option. And he probably did that so that the choice would be obvious. He's probably thinking, I'm going to give them such an obvious choice that Jesus will absolutely go free. But that's why it backfires on him. Jesus Barabbas or Jesus who's called the Messiah? For he knew it was out of self-interest that they had handed Jesus over to him. He doesn't know what's happening, but he knows there's no real guilt here. While Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message. Don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him. I don't know why God sent her this dream. All it does is complicate Pilate's life and certainly make him more accountable, I suppose. And maybe that's why, but you know, it's not like God really wanted things to change here. But nonetheless, he sends this dream, and poor Pilate, who's already feeling the pressure enough as it is, now has this added to the pressure that his wife doesn't want him to do it. And she's had a dream that it's going to cause them a lot of suffering, or for her anyway. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. Which of the two do you want me to release to you? Asked the governor. Barabbas, they answered. What shall I do then with Jesus, who is called the Messiah? Pilate asked. They all answered, crucify him. Why? What crime has he committed? Asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, crucify him. When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, again, the fear, the insurrection, the riot, it's coming. His third strike is about to happen. When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. I am innocent of this man's blood, he said. It is your responsibility. So because of the dream, because none of this makes sense to him, again, it is his responsibility. He's the governor, but he's going to try to pass the buck to them. He tried to pass it to the chief priest. They didn't want it back. He tried to pass it to Herod. Herod didn't want it. He's going to pass it to the crowd now and say, you're responsible. And their answer is interesting. All the people answered, his blood is on us and on our children. And again, we have this incredible type, again, another picture of that, in fact, Jesus' death, his blood is on them and their children, but not in the way they thought. Not in increasing their guilt, but in releasing it. That it's because of the blood of Jesus that we're actually saved and redeemed. So there's just another picture here that John and the gospel writers and God ultimately are giving us of what the gospel is really about. You know, a guilty man is released and Jesus takes his place. The blood of Jesus, which is, you know, should be causing us more guilt, it covers everyone, the Jews and their children, and in a way that they hadn't anticipated. It's just a fascinating sort of insight that we're given there. Then he released Barabbas to them, but he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Luke 23, same story. Pilate called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people and said to them, you brought this man as one who is leading, inciting the people to rebellion. So there it is. We did kind of see that in the Gospels. That's what they were saying. Now we hear it straight out that's what they told Pilate at some point. He's inciting people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence while you were yelling accusations. He doesn't say that, but we know that. I've examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him. But the whole crowd had shouted, away with this man, release Barabbas to us. Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again, but they kept shouting, crucify him, crucify him. For the third time he spoke to them. Why? What crime has been committed? I found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him punished and then release him. It's interesting, given this little bit more detailed version, in the other Gospels, it says that he had him flogged and then released him to be crucified. I think that's true. I think that's the order. This makes it sound like the flogging was another attempt on Pilate's part to go short of crucifixion. That he's like, let me flog him, and now will you take him? And they're like, nope, we still want him dead. And so flogged him and then let him be crucified. But it was an attempt to kind of do something short of actually executing him. But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded he be crucified, and the shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. So what Pilate gets out of all this is he gets friendship with Herod. He gets to lead as governor for a little longer because he didn't incite an insurrection or a riot. And he washes his hands of Jesus, although he is remembered forevermore as the guy who actually condemned Jesus. Let's see. Before we go on to John chapter 19, other thoughts, comments?
Well, you said the thing about, I don't know why, like, God gave his wife this dream. And I was like kind of thinking about it. And I mean, it is like an opportunity for like redemption for Pilate, you know, just as we're going like through Judas and stuff. I mean, you know, like Jesus was giving him every opportunity, and then he gives like Pilate an opportunity. And
yeah, no, I think that's possibly true. I mean, yeah, I think that's true. I think that's right. Ultimately, it kind of increases in his accountability because he had another chance, right? And he turned it down. He had a warning and he ignored it. It shows his self-interest is higher than whatever, his care for his wife or his trust in his wife or his belief in dreams, which wouldn't have been unusual for him to believe that dreams actually meant something. A lot of Romans did.
I can see why he still did it, but yeah.
I think you're right, though. It could just be seen as God giving him a chance to not be the one, you know, who does this.
Yeah, or even like for faith or like whatever.
Yeah.
No, like especially like using a dream.
Yeah, No, I think that's true. That's right. We never hear about Pilate's wife again. You know, I have no idea. She apparently did the right thing, right? She warned Pilate. She tried to get Jesus freed. I don't know what great suffering she experienced.
How would the gospel writer have known about that dream that she had?
Two possibilities. One is divine inspiration. The other is Jesus was there when the messenger came, right? He's sitting there. Maybe he heard it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a good question. It's an interesting detail.
It's only in Matthew's, right?
Yes. Was it Matthew? Yeah, whichever one it's in, it's only in that one.
Interesting.
It seems like maybe that she just, like, the dream, like, was bad. Kind of like having a nightmare. Well, that's how I read it. This says, for I have suffered a great deal today in my dream because of him, not that she like continued to suffer or something.
You might be right. Let me go back and find it for a second.
It says, don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him.
Okay, so I hear what you're saying, and that could mean the dream just caused her anguish. But she says she suffered a great deal in a dream, not because of a dream. So that makes me think that in the dream, she saw her life unfold with suffering because of this. That's how I read it. I'm not saying that's right. But because she said I suffered in a dream, not suffered because of a dream. Even suffering in the dream could just mean emotionally she suffered in the dream because he was innocent and shouldn't be executed. So you could 100% be right. Yeah, that's always an interesting question, Lorraine. Why does Matthew include it, right? They all have different agendas. So what is it about Levi or Matthew that caused him to put this detail in? And one possibility is just that he's the only one who knew it. And why was he the only one who knew it? I don't know. Because Jesus told him, because he happened to be in a position to have heard the rumors about what Pilate's wife told Pilate. Or is it that they all knew this? Because again, it could be a story that people told too, right? Rumors like that would certainly spread. But then why does he include it and the others don't? I don't know the answer to that, but that's always an interesting question to me. When you see something which is in one gospel, not the others, because particularly with Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that means that either Matthew added something that Mark and Luke didn't have, or that Mark and Luke decided not to put in something that they read in Matthew's, depending on how you believe the order of them goes. But it means there was a choice there. Someone absolutely made a choice because they all borrowed from each other so much. They made a choice not to borrow this from each other. So that always fascinates me a little bit. Why? Yes, Meredith.
Well, and
Lorraine, you can go, and then Meredith.
Yeah, fine.
Well, and John was the latest, so he borrowed less. But if it was really important, even if he didn't know it, he certainly could have included it for Matthew's. And it is interesting, like, Matthew's audience is the Jews, and he's showing the way that Jesus fulfilled the prophecies. And so there's the tradition of, like, with Joseph and King Nebuchadnezzar, I guess the Pharaoh and King Nebuchadnezzar, where they have a dream and ask it for it to be interpreted, and you can see like the different way that their rule plays out depending on whether or not they listen to the interpretation of the dream.
Yeah, that's
so it is in keeping with the Jewish tradition.
You're right. Yeah, that fits. That does fit kind of where Matthew's going. Yes, Meredith.
Well, I was kind of thinking too, like, well, I know like Matthew, like in the genealogy, like he includes the women. Does he like, is he the one after Jesus rises that says a lot like about the women coming to see?
I mean, I think
I could see it.
It's just a way.
Well, I could see that is a way like that he might be like showing like value and importance. Like
it could be, like, yeah, because Matthew definitely doesn't have any problem doing that. You're right about that. Yeah, that could be too.
In this case, it almost feels like it emphasizes how far gone the machinations of the people already were. Like, even a divine message is not enough to stop what's happening.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, everybody has gotten themselves in such a knot at this point that, I mean, when you think about that again, Jesus does make the point a couple of times that none of this would happen if it weren't the plan. And I think that it's kind of interesting because when you see the knots they've tied themselves in, for all of them, they get to a certain point, at least Pilate and the chief priests, they get to a certain point where it's like really hard for them to see how they could back out. It's hard to see them go a different direction. And even though Pilate does try to give them all one, I think we do see he's certainly a maneuverer, you know, he tries, but it is like they get so, the machinations get so far that it is, it's almost like they are no longer in control of their own manipulations either. They're just kind of caught up in it. And they, now what? Now the mob isn't even making decisions anymore. They're just kind of yelling things. That's how it feels. It does feel like it kind of gets going and it's just like no one could stop it. And I think that's interesting in light of the fact that God kind of says, yeah, I mean, there is a plan here and it's going to happen because it's the most important plan that's been from the creation of the universe. So, and again, I think like Meredith points out, that doesn't mean that individuals aren't accountable and that maybe God didn't give individuals opportunities to not be the person in that plan. I have no problem with that. Theologically, that's certainly possible. But in a larger picture, just this sense of things almost inevitably moving forward, I think is part of what the gospel writers want us to see, that it's happening. It's kind of like the book of Esther. You kind of just begin to see behind the scenes, God is making everything line up in such a way that Jesus is not only going to die, but he's going to die in a specific way at a specific time with specific charges. You know, it's all playing out the way the prophet said it would. And that is relevant. Yeah. John 19. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in purple robe and went up to him again and again saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they slapped him in the face. I think what this does, the pictures we're starting to get here is, again, this is a riot. This is mob behavior. Even for the chief priests and even for the soldiers of Pilate, this is no longer, if it ever was, and it really wasn't, but even if it ever was, even if it was had a pretense of being a trial and an arrest and an orderly execution, we're way past that. This is just people are out of their minds at this point. They're beating Jesus. They're ridiculing Jesus. They're doing the things that people do when they're caught up in a mob and it seems like it makes sense or nobody cares if it makes sense. It just becomes animalistic. That's kind of the picture we're starting to get. And it doesn't matter who you are, chief priests, the crowd, the soldiers, they're all like animals right now. They're all just kind of doing just incredible things that when CNN talks about them, you know, 6 months later, they would be saying, yeah, I don't know what happened. I don't know how it got that far, but that's what's happening. So here they are, they're putting crown of thorns on his head. They're mocking him for being King of the Jews. They're clothing him in purple and they're just hitting him over and over. And I think, you know, yeah, I think slapping him in the face sounds probably softer. I think this picture we get as we keep going is Jesus is pretty brutally beaten throughout this whole process. So brutally beaten, in fact, that he's unable to carry his own crossbeam, which is unusual. Jesus is a young, strong individual. Other people are carrying their own crossbeams. The only reason I understand Jesus' sort of complete weakness and exhaustion when he actually gets to the crucifixion is because he's just been beaten mercilessly throughout this. Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews gathered there, "Look, I'm bringing him out to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him." So again, I think there's this attempt by Pilate to punish him, flog him, beat him, let him be ridiculed, humiliate him, whatever, anything he can do short of actual crucifixion. And again, I think his concern about crucifixion is he just doesn't want the crowds to get wild either way. So he's like, "Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know I find no basis for a charge against him." When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to him, "Here's the man." As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify, crucify." But Pilate answered, "You take him and crucify him." He's like, "Look, why don't you guys just deal with him?" But the Jews don't crucify. And again, for that doesn't matter to them. More importantly, they are trying to avoid the same thing Pilate's trying to avoid, which is being responsible before the people, let alone before God, but really before the people for killing Jesus. They want Pilate to do it. Pilate wants them to do it. "You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." The Jewish leaders insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die." This, by the way, is the answer to the when they say we're not allowed to kill people. Yes, they are. I mean, according to their law, they are. But again, here, they just don't want to do it. because he claimed to be the Son of God. So now they're like, okay, look, we want him executed for blasphemy. So we're okay if you kill him. Don't worry about that. But Pilate still has no justification for doing it. But at this point, the train has traveled too far down the track. He doesn't know how to push that back. When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid. I think partly because he's like, now I know. The problem is, it's blasphemy. I don't care about blasphemy. And wait, this guy's claiming to be God? That's weird. And my wife had this dream? That's odd. I think just the whole thing, he's like, this is out of control. I don't like it. When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid. And he went back inside the palace. Where do you come from? He asked Jesus. You know, just tell me, where are you from? Who are you? Give me something. But Jesus gave him no answer. Do you refuse to speak to me? Pilate said. And I think the next part is very angry and frustrated. Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you? He's like, why aren't you talking to me? I can set you free. I can crucify you. Answer me. And so Jesus answered, you would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin. Look, he's saying, once the ball was rolling, there's nothing you could do. And it's all over. From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jewish leaders kept shouting, if you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar. So the only thing worse for Pilate than the worry about a riot and an insurrection is if the Jews suddenly start going to Caesar and saying, Pilate isn't on your side. So they're really hitting him where it hurts, right? This is the very thing Pilate's afraid of, that he's going to come out of this looking like he's an enemy of Caesar's. Doesn't want to be seen as an enemy of Caesar's. He just made friends with Herod again. He's just got to get through this without this getting back to Caesar one way or the other. When Pilate heard this, and that's why, when Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out, sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was the day of the preparation of the Passover. It was about noon. That phrase about noon could be midnight, but I think it's probably noon. Here is your king, Pilate said to the Jews, but they shouted, take him away. Take him away and crucify him. Shall I crucify your king? Pilate asked. We have no king but Caesar, the chief priests answered. Okay, this is crazy. The chief priests, again, that in one sense, politically, that's true. It's okay. They're allowed to have a king that isn't God. On another, though, it's a weird thing for a Jew to be saying you could acknowledge that you're not trying to overthrow Caesar without sort of ruling out the idea that God is your king. But they're completely Romans. We have no king but Caesar, the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. Mark, same story. The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is the Praetorium, and called together the whole company of soldiers. They put a purple robe on him, then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him, and they began to call out to him, Hail, King of the Jews. And again, they struck him on the head with a staff. That sounds a lot different than slapping him in the face. Struck him on the head with a staff and spit on him. Falling to their knees, they paid homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they let him out to crucify him. Matthew 27, then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the Praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him and then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand. Then they knelt in front of him and mocked him. Hail, King of the Jews, they said. They spit on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. And after they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. Luke says this, the men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded, prophesy, who hit you? And they said many other insulting things to him. Jim Bishop pulls all this together and points out that what makes most sense chronologically in all these stories, in his understanding, is that this scenario happened more than once, probably three times. Why the same scenario? Because you get a scenario going and people repeat it. So it happens with Herod. It happens with Pilate before he takes him out. And then it happens with Pilate again when he takes him back in, that they keep mocking him for being king. They keep beating him with the staff. They keep saying prophesy. The other possibility is it didn't happen three times. But again, as the gospel writers do, they're just writing about these events that happened. They're not as concerned about exactly where in the scenario they happened. But again, the bottom line, the point that's important for us is that he is being beaten. He is being beaten and spit on and mocked and ridiculed. He's being abused by those in authority and in power. And I think it's a pretty heavy beating. I don't, you know, again, there's no one to stop them. And the fever is kind of upon everybody. And so I think that the soldiers are the worst kind of abusive, oppressive, you know, enforcement right now. And they've got no one to stop them. Nobody is really in Jesus' corner. Pilate's not, he's in his own corner. The chief priests are in their corner. The mob is just being a mob, and some of them are for Barabbas. And no one is in Jesus's corner right now. And so there's nobody to protect him. And he just gets beaten and beaten and beaten and mocked and spit on. And then at the end of that, he gets taken out to be crucified. And we'll pick it up with the crucifixion in 2 weeks. Any comments, any thoughts, any questions on everything we've read tonight?
Well, it seems like John 19:16 seems a little confusing, because it says finally Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified.
Why is that confusing?
Well, because they were trying to get Pilate to crucify him, but over to them seems like, because the chief priest just said we have no king but Caesar, unless it's just saying that finally he handed him over to them, like more like metaphorically. I mean, yeah. I know he's like physically crucified, but
I think it means basically he gave in to them. But even if he handed it over to them, they aren't going to crucify him. They don't have crosses to crucify him. So
yeah,
even if he's handing him to them, all they're doing is walking him to where he's supposed to go be crucified. But I think that what it really means is he gave in to them. He's like, that's fine.
Okay,
we'll crucify him. In Pilate's mind, he's washing his hands of it and handing him over to them. The gospel writers are pretty clear by telling us he sits in the judge's seat, by telling us that ultimately he handed him over, by telling us that he gave up, finally, that Pilate really, as much as he doesn't want to, he is making the decision. He is the final judge and condemner of Jesus. He keeps trying to do it in a way, though, which he isn't. And that's part of what I think it's saying here. By saying he handed him over to them, that's kind of how Pilate sees it. He's like, yeah, that's right, they're going to do it. But they're not going to do it. They can't do it. They don't have the tools, the equipment, the authority, nothing. The Romans are the ones who are going to do it. Just, again, because that's what they do. That's how they execute people. Particularly traitors, particularly people guilty of treason, which is, again, even given what they put on his cross, the whole point is he is not executed for blasphemy. He's executed for treason. The very thing they execute him for, he was never found guilty of by anybody, including Pilate. But he just gives up. So I think that's what it means. I think it just means he gave in to them. He just gave in to them. I suppose there could be a practical logistical item where he does hand him to them and they sort of escort him along with the soldiers. They sort of escort him to the next step of the crucifixion. That's possible. I don't really know how that would have worked, but that could be. So as I said, I think the crucifixion will probably take us a whole time. So we'll do that in 2 weeks. We'll take next week off. Just enjoy your Thanksgiving weekend. And then in 2 weeks, we'll meet, we'll read the crucifixion. Actually, a surprising amount happens in the crucifixion. So we'll read through that. And then we'll finish the Gospels on the 11th of December, the resurrection. And that's the little, any little tidy things after the resurrection in the Gospels. We'll finish that up on the 11th. And then we'll start the new year, either on the 1st or the 8th, with the book of Acts and the epistles.
Thank you for joining us. The Journey is a ministry of Discipleship Matters, which is an extension of Focus Church and is created by David McGill for the purpose of helping equip pastors to build discipleship communities in their own churches. If you'd like to learn more about the books and conferences and coaching offered by David, you can check out his website, davidmcgill.com.